The early bird catches the worms. That's right. Tune in to Early Morning Scoop with David Chombeye, where he unpacks global affairs, analyze issues, dive into the aspects of human development, connecting policymakers with the citizens, and encouraging critical, constructive, and positive criticism Monday to Friday from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. Don't miss out.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And welcome. Good morning, dear listeners. Wherever you find yourself, you're obviously up, kicking, having a coffee in your hand, or potentially something warm. I will not dispute what, nor try to explore what it might be. Here's the particular thing to look at primarily when you've got to look at this morning's, EMS. Specifically, I do hope that you might have enjoyed some lovely showers, because here with us here in Windhoek, it was just sort of like flirting with us and then decided to tell us, you know what, I'll see you guys on another day, potentially just give you the nice little cold weather or chilly weather in that scenario, and ultimately just, you know, send you on your way from there on, leaving you with a little bit of some nimbus stratos high up in the sky just to block out any potential sun rays that we would be depending on for the day. But I do hope, in terms of this morning's early morning scoop, as well as also the discussions that we've got lined up for you, primarily that you are up about and getting ready for your particular day on this Wednesday morning. And it is the Villager, specifically, it's a Wednesday, so the Villager, the Wednesday edition of the Villager is out. If you are part of our subscription process, you know, obviously, do have a gander. If you're not, I really do not know where you've been. All you've got to do is just follow some of the prompts that we've got on our social media platforms in terms of, you know, laying down how you can join. If you've also follow us on our WhatsApp channels, we also sort of like give you a snippet there, sensitize you there a little bit in terms of the billers that we bring out on our social media platforms as well. But predominantly, there's also the website that you can also, you know, subscribe to, primarily, because it's not a paid-for subscription, but it just helps us actually know how many viewers, readers, visitors we get to our website as well. But beside that, welcoming you in earnest to this morning's session of the Early Morning Scoop. And as we always do, dear listeners, we step into and we will start off with the international news segment immediately. Now, specifically getting into the major talking point coming through on the African continent, which has been the discussion around the Sudan civil war. And this is as accusations come through from the UN specifically that money, weapons and diplomatic support from regional actors are responsible for much of the atrocities in Sudan. Now, this is primarily as the UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres is calling for an immediate end to what he calls a nightmare of violence in Sudan. And this is as last week the paramilitary rapid support forces seized the besieged city of El Fasher from the Sudanese army. Now, this is as a major turning point in Sudan's war has obviously happened right there, which cements RSF control of Western Darfur, which is technically almost a third of the country in a sort of like a block in itself. Now, since then, horrifying reports have been emerging from El Fasher. The RSF is accused of carrying out mass executions and other atrocities. We take a listen to this report.
Time to get a better understanding of the situation in Sudan, where UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an immediate end to what he calls a nightmare of violence. Just over a week ago, the paramilitary Rapid Defense Forces, Rapid Support Forces, or RSF as they're known, seized the besieged city of El Fasher from Sudanese army forces. It's a major turning point in Sudan's war, cementing RSF control of the Western Darfur region. Since then, horrifying reports have been emerging from El Fasher. The RSF is accused of carrying out mass executions and other atrocities. Satellite images taken from space show blood-stained sands. The fate of 200,000 civilians trapped in the city is unclear. Since April of 2023, the RSF has been involved in a power struggle with the Sudanese army, but it's a story that goes far beyond Sudan's border, with numerous global powers playing a role in the conflict.
More than 2 years of brutal war in Sudan have created the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. Thousands have been killed and millions have been displaced. The war centers on two rival militaries and their fight for power. On the one side is the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Himedti. On the other side is the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, led by Abdel Fattah Burhan. Once allies in their fight to overthrow Sudan's former government, they became enemies in the aftermath of the 2021 coup. Abdel Fattah Burhan is Sudan's de facto leader and represents Sudan on the global stage. Himedti's RSF has its origins in the Janjaweed militia, which was accused of genocide and ethnic cleansing against the Darfur region's non-Arab population in the mid-2000s.
It's history repeating, and it becomes worse every time a place is taken over by the other party.
Over the past 2 years of fighting, both the RSF and the SAF have been accused of war crimes and atrocities. International backers are also alleged to be supplying weapons to the conflict. Multiple UN reports accuse the United Arab Emirates of providing weapons to the RSF, claims Abu Dhabi denies, and Sudan's armed forces have support from Egypt. While those are the two key players, there are plenty of others allegedly providing military support or with strategic interests in the conflict. They're being called on to put an end to the war.
One thing that is essential to stop the fighting is to make sure that no more weapons come into Sudan.
Calls for a ceasefire have done nothing to stop the bloodshed, with both sides determined to claim victory and complete control of Sudan.
Federico Donnelli is an associate professor of international relations at the University of Trieste in Italy, and I asked him to explain who supports who in this conflict and why.
Well, when we consider the Sudanese civil war, we have to consider the involvement of multiple actors. As you said, there are two main actors that are Egypt and UAE. But of course, with Egypt, there's also Saudi Arabia. These two actors are backing the Sudanese army forces, so Al Burhan, and it's really about history and geography, I would say, because they've got old tie with Sudan military and share security concern, especially Saudi Arabia in the Red Sea, but also for Egypt is related to the Nile River. On the other end, we've got the UAE, the Emirates, who support the Rapid Support Forces and the MAT. This is mainly driven by business and strategy, because we have to consider the importance of the access to gold, trade routes, and also influence along the Red Sea corridor. So in short, when we consider Sudanese civil war, we have to consider a much bigger and broader picture with the competition for regional influence among different players.
Mm-hmm. There are many geopolitical interests at play here, as you just pointed out. Some analysts are calling this a proxy war. Would you agree with them?
Not exactly. I can totally understand why they say proxy war, but I think it's important to underline that the core of this civil war is related to internal power struggle between the two security sectors.
We'll quickly take a short break and come back right after this.
Great news! Imbert just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imbert? Get all exclusive features for just $36 Namibian a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Of the Sudanese army, so we've got on one end the formal army and on the other end the paramilitary groups. Of course, if we consider the external players, I think that their involvement, they support with money, weapons, and diplomatic support have turned the war in a bigger things. So this is definitely important. So I would say it's not a fully proxy war. It's a domestic conflict with clear regional layers.
Mm-hmm. I want to zoom in on the Gulf monarchies because their engagement in Sudan didn't start just 2 years ago, did it?
No, it didn't start 2 years ago. When we consider the Gulf monarchies, we have to consider that they began to get engaged in Sudan even during the al-Bashir era. And they were engaged because they want to counter the influence of Iran, especially following the Yemen civil war. With the Yemen civil war, Sudan and the whole Horn of Africa became important for regional competition. Then they've got other interests in Sudan. These interests are related to food security, for example, with the land grabbing phenomenon that became really important for Saudi Arabia. And of course, in projecting influence not only against Iran, but also against some other Middle Eastern players like Qatar, Israel, and Turkey.
So we have the UAE backing the RSF. We have Saudi Arabia backing the SAF. How has that, in your opinion, stoked the flames of the internal conflict in Sudan?
I think it makes things a lot harder. I mean, the UAE has been closer to RSF and Saudi Arabia on the other side. This is a rivalry. This is a new rivalry for the region because they were allied before. And this is a rivalry related to multiple political issues. When we consider the idea of the future of the region, they've got different positions. From UAE side, there's no space for the political Islam in the region. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia is open to get closer to political Islam. And this is something that we have seen not only in Sudan, but also in Yemen. At the same time, I think that the lack of unified Arab states or Gulf position also make weaker any mediation efforts, as we have seen with the quote. It also allows Sudanese actors to play against one side against the other. So they can gain a lot, they can maximize, they benefit from this rivalry.
How much influence, though, in real terms, do they have over the warring factions they support?
Quite a lot. They've got quite a lot of influence, but they are not in total control. I mean, this is important to underline because when we consider the dynamics, the conflict dynamics, we have to be aware that they do not have the full control. Money and logistics give leverage, but both the army and the RSF act on their own interests. So they are not following the interest or the strategy or the agenda of the Gulf monarch. Local power dynamics and personal rivalries, so from one side, Al-Burhan, and from the other side, Emeti, still matter more than any outside patron monarchy.
Now the UAE has expressed regret over its inaction during the coup in 2021 that overthrew the civilian transition government. Are they getting ready to walk away from the RSF?
I think that behind the UAE position and the current position, there are also the interest in some way to try to reset their image, especially international image, with European countries and United States, of course. And maybe by stepping up humanitarian aid or getting more involved in mediation efforts in the next weeks, especially with the atrocities that we have seen in the recent day. And another option would be to tighten control over the gold exports. This is important because for UAE, gold is really a key driver for the involvement in Sudanese civil war, because gold is determinant to provide financial support to the networks of its ally, not only in Sudan, but in the wider region.
Now we also step into another particular dimension that takes us, that gives us a particular perspective on the developments coming through from a climate change perspective. Now this is as disagreements in the EU bloc are persisting in this regard. Now EU member states are trying to define the bloc's climate targets ahead of this month's COP30 conference in Brazil, and the EU ministers in Brussels are seeking to commit to their ambitious targets. We take a listen to this report.
And for the European Union's governments who are trying to define the bloc's climate targets ahead of this month's COP conference in Brazil. EU ministers in Brussels are pushing ambitious targets to take to the annual UN Global Climate Summit, which they hope will encourage other nations to follow their lead. But there's been widespread disagreement amongst the EU's 27 countries from the outset.
Germany and Italy are worried EU plans to phase out combustion engine cars will cripple their industry. Hungary, Poland, Czechia and Slovakia say EU climate targets are unrealistic and that their energy supplies can't adapt quickly enough. So EU ministers are meeting in Brussels at the business end of the battle on what their emissions reduction targets should be. Last month, the EU Commission President remained hopeful.
We saw support for an ambitious and pragmatic approach at the same time. So we also discussed the flexibilities to get to this goal, first in form of international credits and second through flexibilities between the different economic sectors.
In order to put forward a unified front on the global stage, EU countries first have to agree to their own internal targets. There's a fixed goal of full climate neutrality in the EU by 2050, already signed off. On the road to getting there, the EU wanted its members to commit to a 2040 target, a 90% reduction on 1990 levels of emissions. But the really complex discussion is about the 2035 target. The proposal was for a cut between a bracket range of around 66% to 72%. The EU already missed a deadline to submit a reductions pledge ahead of the annual UN climate conference. Climate watchers say heading to Brazil without a fixed number target would be a bad look for the EU.
It would be a disastrous a signal to the rest of the world, because, I mean, the number would be like very large and clear. So that would be probably not good for the EU's international image.
EU countries are also negotiating how much they can outsource this problem by paying other countries around the world to plant forests or capture carbon, doing their emissions reductions for them.
That report by Jack Perrick, who joins me now from Brussels. Jack, talks are dragging on. The ministers are still discussing the 2040 target. What are the sticking points?
Yeah, we know that they still haven't moved on from that. I just got off the phone with an EU official that is close to these talks, and they described it as two tribes, the realists and the idealists. This person, to be fair, was coming from one of the member states that would consider itself a realist. These are the countries that say that being too ambitious on the targets, trying to get to this 90% would be stupid if there aren't serious plans in place. This 90% target of emissions reductions on 1990 levels by 2040. One of the things that they're having to discuss is, at the moment, and we know this is one of the complications, is how much they can offset their emissions. Countries like Poland have been public. They say that they should be allowed 10% of their emissions if they pay another country to plant forests to offset the emissions that they themselves are emitting. We understand that France is saying that that number should be 5% of their emissions minimum. Other countries, Germany, for instance, is saying it needs to be down near 3%, that the onus should be on the European countries themselves to restrict their emissions. Now, we know that that 2040 target, I won't explain all of the complications and the reasons why, but they need to agree that 2040 target before they can look at the 2035 target. They can do that through, they don't need unanimity, they don't need all countries to agree for the 2040 target, but it shows that it's already too complicated, even without unanimity. The deal for the 2035 target, which is the one that they need to take to the COP in Brazil, that needs full agreement across the member states. So things are really, really complicated and looking likely to drag on much, much further.
if there is no agreement before COP30, what will that mean for the EU's negotiating position?
Well, it will be a disastrous look, essentially. That's the main problem. The EU sees itself as the climate leader. The Paris Agreement was signed in France in an EU member state. And they are trying to push other countries around the world to be more ambitious, especially with the United States, with Donald Trump pulling the US out of the climate agreements, China dragging its feet on many of its sort of climate pledges, according to the Europeans and to other member states around the world. So it just wouldn't be a particularly good look for the Europeans. But like I say, some of the EU countries are saying we still need to be realistic. There's the 2050 target of climate neutrality, full emissions neutrality. So that's already signed off on. And a lot of the countries are saying, why are we battling ourselves needing to try and go through this process, sort of self-flagellating on these targets when we've already got the big target in sight?
Now, before we end off on our early mornings Scoops international segment specifically, we still have a chance to still stay in Africa. And this is as a global inequality report had been released as well by the Global Council on Inequality. Now, this is in its first ever report. The Global Council's report is sounding the alarm on the rising levels of global inequality. And remember, this is as the particular engagement in Doha, Qatar is currently in going into day two, that being the World Summit on Social Justice. And the particular discussion looked at, the particular report looked at the global inequality, or the rising levels of global inequality, which are posing major threats to the scale and impact of pandemics. The council also noted that the high debt and budget constraints that face low-income countries make it impossible to allocate more funding and resources to healthcare priorities. We have a listen to this report.
Is the director of Center for Global Health Policy and Politics at Georgetown University, United States of America, and he now joins us for more on this. Matthew, to begin the conversation here, when we talk about inequality, we often talk about the coefficient between the rich and the poor, the measurement of the distance, at least, between the rich and the poor, not necessarily an erosion of poverty in and of itself. And when we often ask about how do we close the gap, the answer often is about lifting those in poverty out of poverty and not necessarily curtailing runaway wealth, which often is a function of injustice. Do we have the right approach in how we normatively frame conversations of inequality?
You know, that's a really important point, because what we're talking about here in this report, as well as the report that accompanied it that looked at pandemics, is not just is there poverty and do poor people, for example, do poorly during pandemics, but instead we're asking, does the distance between the rich and the poor matter? Does it matter when some people are able to make billions and billions of rand and dollars and others are living on almost nothing? Does that actually have an impact? And what we have found through this report and the report that's linked to it on pandemics is that actually it makes a big difference. That actually the more inequality we have, for example, the more likely a pandemic is. Countries, for example, that had higher inequality have had higher deaths from HIV.
Yeah. Can I ask,
higher rates of HIV, et cetera.
Can I ask this? Why does that distance matter? I'm assuming we don't live in a zero-sum economy where there is a static, finite, limited resources. While it is limited, it's not static, right? That is to say, I don't assume that somebody only get rich if somebody gets poor in a zero-sum calculus. So why does that distance matter?
It matters because it turns out it's disabling for society. It turns out that actually countries around the world that are seeing huge rates of inequality have real trouble trying to come up with universal policies, have real trouble trying to struggle to achieve stopping pandemics, for example, or addressing people's health. That gap, it's not just poverty that matters. It's actually the gap between the rich and the poor, because some people, for example, in the middle of COVID, they were fine. They were able to exit, and they didn't invest in the society. And so the poor were absolutely harmed, but it's the existence of that gap that really matters.
Is the effectual relationship between pandemic, public health, on the one hand, and inequality on the other hand, causation or correlative?
It's causation. We find when we dug deep that inequality causes outbreaks to become pandemics. that inequality causes pandemics, once they're there, to be longer and deeper and more disruptive. And then inequality is the result of pandemics because some people do well. For example, you know, some people made billions of dollars in the middle of the pandemic by selling vaccines, but only to some people. Apologies for the background. And so that inequality pandemic cycle is exactly what we find is causal. And it can be disrupted.
Yeah. How do we then break that cycle, right? One, South Africa has a good case study, for instance, on the provision of ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, free of charge, despite what seemed like restrictive IP restrictions around the production of generics. Once we were able to get past that, we were able to provide it. Yet the inequality coefficient of South Africa hasn't changed positively in the interceding period. It seems that though non-economic approaches can break the cycle, what are we not doing right?
So we've got a few different things that are worth unpacking. One is there's within-country inequality, and there's also between-country inequality. And so as we think about pandemics especially, one of the most important things is the distance between the countries that have access to, for example, COVID-19 vaccines. The fact that there was 6 months to a year between the time that folks in Europe and North America were able to get access to vaccines and that same time that folks in South Africa and India were able to get access to vaccines wasn't just harmful and painful for people living in South Africa, but it actually gave rise to the kind of Omicron and Delta variants that we saw. It created an entire world of fueled pandemics because we didn't share inequality, because we didn't actually share those vaccines equally. We could be making vaccines for COVID in South Africa. We could also be making the most cutting-edge HIV medicines in South Africa. Right now, for example, there's this drug, lenacapavir. It can stop HIV with two shots a year, and yet it's only being made in a handful of countries and not in the United States. Then we've also got to think about the within-country inequality. And as your question was asking there, when there's big inequalities within countries, what we see we're not addressing is not just the medicines, but also what we call the social determinants of health. Those are things like housing, right? Those are things like income. They're things like education. And so, for example, we know that surging social protection to young women facing HIV is as effective as medicine in many ways, right? Because it gives them the power to make choices. The same thing turned out to be true during COVID-19. So it's not just all about medicines. It's also about those social determinants of how do we address it. And more unequal societies are less effective at addressing those social determinants, no matter how many medicines or good tests they've got in a laboratory.
Yeah. Are we able to change pandemic preparedness in the global south without necessarily having to change the political economy that defines the global south?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. And I think the answer to some degree is no. That we have to actually understand that despite all of the amazing science that's happened, we have never seen the kind of ability to fight diseases with medicine that we've ever seen before. We can detect diseases in a matter of hours often. And yet we still have not just HIV, but also COVID, but also Mpox, but also Ebola. And that reality is coming from the inequality that we're seeing around the world. And so we've got to address the ways in which political economy, as you say, is coming in. For example, some countries in the world have the ability to actually address pandemics, while others are actually seeing high and rising debt. Some people are able to actually stay home during a pandemic, and others can't because they need to be out getting food. And so that's a huge crisis when it comes to actually trying to do pandemics, and we can't imagine that somehow we'll get out of that by just having more and better tests or more and better medicines.
Yeah. Matthew Kavanaugh, we're going to have to leave it. Thank you so much for your time.
And on that particular note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end of this morning session of the international news segment here on the EMS. We'll quickly be taking a short break and come back right after that.
The early birds catches the worms. That's right. Tune in to Early Morning Scoop with David Chombeli, where he unpacks global affairs, analyze issues, dive into the aspects of human development, connecting policymakers with the citizens, and encouraging critical, constructive, and positive criticism Monday to Friday from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. Don't miss out.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tele ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshefa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Okone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge fata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
We come back, dear listeners, from the quick break right there, and just getting into the local news segment. And before we do that, since it is a Wednesday session of, or a Wednesday, primarily, there is the Villager e-paper platform to slightly peruse through and give you some of the major talking points coming through right there. For this morning's edition, just in terms of not providing you with a spoiler alert, but just giving you a slightly, a little bit of a slight insight, there's obviously this morning's particular lead for the discussion on a call for Namibia to shift from a non-transformational growth. Non-transformational growth, it just means or just translates also, dear listeners, to the dimension of primarily diversifying your economy. Non-transformational also implies that there's only heightened interest or heightened attention placed at certain particular sectors to continue or to be the bedrock or to be the particular sort of like foundation of your economy, which happens all across the world primarily, but in many particular cases, the easiest particular paths are always just focus on what are your strengths as well as also then try to use those strong points to try and build up the weaker ones. It's the basics of the SWOT analysis or the theory of the SWOT analysis or the whole ambition and aim of the SWOT analysis is that you always have to identify strengths and weaknesses, opportunities and threats, and how you can maximize opportunities from your strengths, from your strong points. Try to avert any particular weaknesses or try to lessen their impact and thus try to mitigate any threats that would obviously show out. It's the basics of this particular thing. Don't worry, it took me a little bit of a long time to try and understand that as well. Obviously, being on university, sometimes your mind is focused on other things. But the particular ethos right there from the SWOT analysis is that specifically, it's the same particular aspect that many economists have been calling for in terms of Namibia's particular growth and even what Namibia should be focusing on. And this is obviously as the executive director of the Ministry of Finance, just to give you a small snippet of the lead article, has consented that Namibia needs to shift from economic growth for its own sake to growth that is linked to economic transformation, adding that the current government policies have paved the way for such a shift. So obviously just giving you a slight insight right there, and that is the e-paper's lead for this morning. Other particular talking points that also stem from this morning's edition is the particular discussion on the light industries that City of Windhoek must actually do more to support. This comes through from a recent parliamentarian visit, oversight committee visit to the City of Windhoek Council, specifically providing insights there. And this is also as the next particular article on page five, cites also the particular investment into streetlight projects to illuminate the Ndiona settlement. That's coming from our Kavango East correspondent, that being Anakleta Hakera, providing insights in terms of a developmental project earmarked there for the Ndiona a settlement in the, well, alongside the B8 road. And this is a particular settlement, primarily that is found there in the Kavango East. Other particular talking points stemming from this is support for basketball in the country, as well as also you can have a look there at some of the opinion pieces talking about some insightful takes. We've got an interesting read there specifically from a, one of the particular advertisers, specifically from the Institute of the International University of Management, in terms of looking at a particular sort of like an account from a, well, is an MP, but also a particular alumnus. So if you, if you have any opportunity and you've also subscribed to our e-paper, you can always have a gander in terms of the talking points that emanate from this morning's edition of the Villager e-paper. Now, stepping into the rest of our local news segment. Now, the latest trade statistics for the period of September 2025 indicated a decrease in activity, specifically following on from the previous month of August. Now, this is as the Namibia Statistics Agency said that Namibia's export revenue for September 2025 stood at 7.4 billion Namibian dollars. This reflected a particular decrease from a decrease of 3.8% when compared to the export value that was recorded in August alone. Now, whereas the country's expenditure on imports stood at 10.8 billion Namibian dollars, this reflected a decrease of 16.4% from the 12.9 billion that was recorded in August. Now, the export and import positions were translated into a trade deficit of 3.4 billion, mainly due to imports that outpaced exports. Now, obviously, taking a particular look in terms of the latest particular trade report that was released recently, some of the particular talking points is that this is predominantly positioned on international merchandise trade statistics, which measures the quantity and the value of merchandised goods or goods moving into and out of the country, which obviously add to or subtract from the country's material stock of goods. Now, still focusing on in some of the particular developments that obviously stood there, the Namibia's international merchandise trade statistics, which are subject to a revision as new information from data sources also become available, and primarily these provided for some of the particular talking points that we cited just recently. Now, the particular notion obviously that stemmed from this is as the discussion in terms of the cumulative trade values is that Namibia's cumulative exports amounted to 91 billion Namibian dollars during this month of September, and this also indicated a particular increase when compared to the 83.9 billion registered of the same period for the previous year. Now, this is on the import side, the similar particular value, that being the cumulative value of the for the month under the review, which was for September this year, amounted to 109 billion Namibian dollars, and specifically the import side also indicated that this was lower by 4.1 billion when compared to the 113 billion Namibian dollars, which was recorded over the same period back in 2024. Thus indicating that 2024's month of September, it was a better performing month than the 2025 version. The particular aspects in terms of what were some of the details in terms of the goods also that were moving and coming in, going into and coming out of the country is that the monthly decrease in exports of goods was mainly reflected in non-monetary gold, which went down by 833 million, copper and articles of copper, which went down by 452 million, fish, which went down by 359 million, ores and other concentrates of base metals, which went down by 302 million, and petroleum oils, which went down by 154 million Namibian dollars. The other particular decreases in imports of goods were also reflected mainly in civil engineering and contractors' equipment, which went down by 247 million, sulfur and unroasted iron pyrites, down by 204 million as well, motor vehicles for the transportation of persons, down by 182 million, rotating electric plant and parts, which also went down by 176 million, and aircraft and associated equipment that went down by 163 million. Now, in terms of looking at the particular industry-affiliated indications, the report also noted that the discussion on all economic activities consists of the look or the view in terms of coherent and also consistent classification structures. Now, some of the particular talking points that emanate from this is that regarding the sectoral distribution of total exports for September 2025, this saw that the mining sector occupied the first position once again with the largest export value of 3.6 billion. This contributed to about 48.4% in terms of the country's total export revenue, with the exports of products from this particular sector increasing by 1.7 billion when compared to the previous month of August. The manufacturing sector of the country also emerged in second position, accounting for at least 47.5% of total exports in September. However, the export value of the goods from the sector also slumped, dropping by 1.9 billion Namibian dollars when compared to the previous month. This was for August 2025. And on top of this, agriculture, forestry and fishing sector ranked third, contributing a mere 3.4% to the country's total exports. Now, this also highlighted some of the particular talking points, and that the demand side displayed the country's reliance on foreign manufactured goods after recording a huge import flows of products from this particular industry. In September alone, the import bill for products from the manufacturing industry stood at 7.6 billion Namibian dollars, which indicated a 21.2% decrease when compared to August of 2025. And following in second position was the mining and quarrying industry, which stood at 2.7 billion, reflecting a 9.8% decrease when compared to the preceding month. Finally, the agriculture, forestry and fishing sector, which also occupies the third position as well in this particular discussion, occupied the third position with imports valued at 480 million Namibian dollars. The total exports and the total imports also highlighted a significant particular picture in terms of these particular dynamics. During the month, the export revenue declined by 3.8% to 7.4 billion when compared to the exports that were recorded in August of 2025. On top of this, the exports decreased by 16% when compared to the 8.8 billion that was registered in the corresponding month of 2024. September 2025's data also indicates that the import value amounted to 10.8 billion, which reflected a decrease in both month-on-month and year-on-year respective comparisons to at least 16.4% and 25.4%. Now, that ultimately does bring us up to the end of that particular insightful discussion. We also take a look once again at an interesting discussion that comes through in our next report. Now, still staying on the discussion here of local news developments, a presentation that focused on integrated flood and drought early warning systems in Namibia's Kuvalai Basin, which was presented at the recently climate change and futures conference. A local Namibian academic known as Dr. Percent Frans from the University of Namibia gave a particular insight in terms of the various particular characteristics around integrated flood and drought early warning systems, and some of the other particular characteristics in some of the mitigating strategies that have been explored in the Namibian context. For more, we have a listen to this report.
Use these historical data to actually do the analysis and predictions, and actually to feed it later on into an early warning system is quite challenging. That's the reason why I think going to global geospatial systems that is currently actually now, I think I've compared three of them, there's actually more than five of them, where they've actually done analysis on a global scale. And these analysis is also helping in terms of AI, which you can then use your local data to help ground this data. So my topic, I've actually changed it a little bit here, but it's actually the same: bridging the gap, early evaluating early warning systems for flood and drought in our Kuvalai Basin, which is in the north. So what I've explained now is global data. Since, as you can also hear, I think our director was here of disaster management, and you could hear what he was saying, the disconnect between the units that actually manage the data and how these units don't talk to each other. So do you have an early warning system? You need to have an integrated system for data and, also, of course, communication, as I want to then discuss in this particular presentation. And then, of course, local action. So, as you can see here, this is Southern Africa on your left, where the basin is. So you can see that particular area is quite flooded most often. Also, if flooding happened, what is nice, in 2008, 2009, 2011, we had this nice international charter organization. So where there's flooding and more than 10 people, of course, die, they actually reconfigure the satellites to that particular area, and then they capture the data which we can then use. Of course, the data can only be used for that particular flood event or drought event, and then this is actually where most of our data is, because as you can also know, satellite data is quite expensive, and also human capacity in Namibia is quite a challenge. This image just shows you then a more wider view of Southern Africa, and then, of course, specifically the flooding in 2011, and then the red era, just what the impact was on the ground, and then the disconnect between, of course, as you could see there, between. So just the background. As I mentioned before, we have got more than a million people living in our northern area. We had actually more than 8 major floods in that particular area. That area is mostly a rural area, but of course fast urbanization is also taking place in that particular area. We also had a lot of agricultural-based services in that particular area where people actually rely a lot on that. And as you can see also, we had almost 6 severe flood drought events in that area as well. And what we wanted to explain in this is then to talk, despite the global satellite monitoring, local communities still receive late or no warning. So even though, if you look at what I've explained, the gap analysis I want to do, even though it is global systems, some warning did come early, and that is a disconnect. We actually want to talk about the early warning gap. The central question is what I want to find out, or what we want to find out, is how can we translate sophisticated global focus into life-saving action for communities on the front line of climate change. In this particular case, a critical disconnect exists between the micro scale from global geospatial early warning systems to make micro actionable decisions needed by households, which create then, of course, this chain dangerous lack in response. So usually, as I mentioned before, because of the technology and big data, there's quite a lot of systems available. The one that the gentleman also in the presentation this morning was talking about was the GLOFAS, which is then a European system. You've got then a NASA system. Then you also have one that is funded by USAID. And then, of course, we have got our OSA SADC DMC, which also then have data on a global scale, or not a global scale, but a little bit a micro scale. And then, of course, what we want to do is just to look at the flood for 2009, 2011, which was major floods in Namibia, and then, of course, the drought of 2012 and then 15, which was also major. Here, as I mentioned before, we want to identify the specific socio-technical disconnects. Usually, as scientists who use data, we usually talk about the spatial resolution of your data, and then the impact that will have on the local community. And in this case, what we found is that even though this models was a global scale, they did actually give lead time, and most of them actually help if the communication was good, and then of course the actionability was also executed, as you could hear from the disconnect within the disaster management system in Namibia. This would have helped if we have actually take note of that.
Now, still continuing on, Dr. Franz highlighted some of the particular findings that were also reflected in a Namibian context, stating that specifically some of the findings were pretty interesting in terms of the picture that they sketched. We have a listen to what he said.
So just background on this is, of course, the people-centered and end-to-end early warning systems using global systems, as well as then research on the hydrology of the Kovalai. As the previous speaker also mentioned, we have a similar case where we have the area where we're talking about is quite flat. It's actually flat for there's almost no evaluation in terms of water flowing anywhere. So when it rained, local rain, and then of course rain coming from the water coming from Angola, it caused quite a massive flooding. In this case, what we also want to do in terms of breaching the last mile is where you really bring down those warnings to the communities that need it the most. So just briefly, the conceptual framework. Here what we're talking about is historical data. Also, as you could see, the processing of this big data is quite a challenge, especially in a country like Namibia where we don't have so much human capacity. So usually the systems quite work well. Of course, the cloud processing also work well. And then, of course, if you then feed it into this particular systems, it also help where there's areas where there's no data. It can help with the different interpolation methods to then give you then some sort of an estimate what it. So we also look at government and UN impact reports, and then of course satellite like the European satellite signal, which is quite a high resolution. Then of course what we want to do is just to look at the timeliness, look going back to see even though this is global systems, what did they indicate, whether it went down to the particular communities and what was the disconnect in that. And specifically, as I mentioned before, since it's global data, spatial granularity is quite a problem that we want to see whether, even though it was coarse data, can it actually help with the actionability on the ground? The output is then just a conceptual model for integrated system. So if you look in the left, just to show you, in this case, this is the area. On your left, you can see there's a 20-year return period exceedance, which was then predicted. Then they also calculate for us the flood hazard for 100 years. We don't have that type of data, but of course, they use different methods from this particular geospatial system. They also have then precipitation, telling you then if the rainfall is more than 50 meters, and then they did so that we can warn our community. And then of course the impact, as you can see in the big one on your right. So in this case, as you can see, even though there was the systems like correctly predicted basin-wide events, but the resolution is to cause to identify at-risk home states, a known limitation in Southern Africa. This combined with fragmented communication to village remains renders, of course, warnings ineffective for especially last minute. So in both, as I've mentioned now, in both cases, as you can see, even though it's caused, It gives you a lead time, but because of communication, it also creates a big problem. If you look at the drought situation as well, so you need in most cases.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat oder spare noch mehr mit unseren speziellen Abonnementplänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
You look at
the drought situation as well. So you need, in most cases, if you look at the drought indexes from this particular...
There's no price like the ShopRite price. That's why we're committed to bringing you lower prices on all the essentials you need. Like 6x1 liter Rite brand long life full cream milk for only 119 Namibian dollars 99 per pack. And 4 kg real good frozen chicken, mixed portions, only 194 Namibian dollars 99. Never pay more than the ShopRite price. Valid until 9 November 2025. Only at ShopRite. Catch Ready, Steady, Cook on One Africa. Proudly brought to you by ShopRite Namibia.
Now we come back there, and just before the ad break itself, the insightful discussion obviously that emanated from the talking point of some of the research that obviously had been presented here in Windhoek recently at the particular Climate Change and Futures Conference. Now, we step into the particular talking point of our in-depth discussion for this morning's session, and we take a particular look at the development that is coming through technically from Doha, Qatar. And this is as it is being touted that it's this massive global summit. And don't worry, guys, I asked this particular question where all these world leaders and, you know, big decision makers are now congregating. But the summit's name is the World Summit for Social Development, which is currently taking place in Doha, Qatar, from 4 to 6 November. Now, Namibia has signaled that they will have a delegation at the global event as the world's leaders congregate to engage on the various challenges facing humanity in terms of combating the various, combating these various challenges itself. Now, the discussion obviously cites that Namibia, back in last week specifically, the Ministry of Justice and the Office of the Prime Minister engaged in a meeting specifically about, you know, who would be attending this. And in terms of the delegation, it has been identified that Prime Minister Elijah Ngurare will lead a delegation to Doha, and that the particular discussion is based upon the draft political declaration of the Second World Summit for Social Development to be adopted at this platform. Now, the discussions will focus on the three central pillars, that being eradication of poverty, full and productive employment, and decent work for all, and finally, social integration. The participants for this particular discussion, obviously, being from around the world, are all heads of state and decision makers around the world specifically that have or can contribute towards a sustainable society. However, for this morning's discussion, dear listeners, we speak to a social justice activist, that being Mr. Lloyd Bock. In terms of just looking at the particular talking points, the three pillars itself, looking at the particular signal in terms of what this actually explains, but also balancing the particular challenges and some of the particular talking points for like Namibia's unique position, which is ultimately what the Namibian delegation would like to go and communicate at this summit in Doha. And secondly, the particular talking points in terms of what we see here in Namibia and ultimately some of the goals that are being aimed or trying to be achieved at a later stage. We have a listen to this engagement here with Mr. Lloyd Bock, the social justice activist. And joining me this morning for the early morning scoop, in terms of having this particular in-depth discussion about social justice and primarily what does it actually mean in terms of the realm that's taking place, the particular event and conference that's taking place in Qatar, Doha, or in Doha, Qatar. And this is obviously also where it has been alluded to that we will also have Namibian representatives taking place there, or primarily where our Prime Minister Ngurare will also be in attendance. The summit is slated to run from 4 to 6 November, and specifically joining me on this particular discussion as we look at the essence or the core message that this particular summit tries to answer, tries to achieve, I'm joined by a social justice activist and advocate himself, that being Mr. Lloyd Bock. Lloyd, thank you for taking the time and good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you for having me as well.
100%, 100%, Lloyd. Lloyd, the last time you and I spoke, we obviously were doing this from a youth-based discussion and the social justice perspective to help and assist vulnerable youth, which were some of the particular concerns that you brought to light in our various discussions here at Eagle FM. But on this particular setting, we are now amplifying this to a global setting. You know, we're taking this a lot more larger and to a broader scale. Firstly, let me ask you on this particular note, what do you think about having a summit and heads of state and very powerful men and women from governments coming together and technically trying to talk about the subject matter? Because I'll just set the scene for you. There's a lot of powerful people who also earn a lot of money having to talk about deprivations, poverty, inequality, vulnerability, as well as also various other particular stresses that the populations around the world face. What do you think about this particular setting?
Well, Dwight, based on my opinion, I can say we are a world that is very good at making money. I think making money is not the problem here, but it's the equitable distribution of it. Mm. Are we distributing this wealth? Are we distributing what we create equitably within our people and other grassroots communities benefiting from it? And you are right, it's world leaders, but are we concerned about the young people on the ground, about the youth at our ground? Because we also know we are also talking about women and children as well. We're also talking about men as well within this world. And we are affected globally by so many challenges. And then I think it is very important that this summit really looks at inclusivity and what inclusivity means in its real sense. Mm. Because without inclusivity, we are not addressing all the issues in the world. If there is this large gap between the decisions that the people on the grassroots make and the decisions that are being made on the top level, we are never going to meet each other. Mm. Because at the end of the day, we want a just world. And we want to achieve this social justice. We have to create a playing field where dialogues can also happen at all levels, basically. And these groups, and it should not be about them against us type of decision, because although we make decisions often, it becomes an issue where the wealthy community often meets together and the community that is trying to make it meet together. And that is where the gap is. Let's exchange ideas also on all playing fields. But then the conference is very important because it basically also talks about sustainability and how we can create a sustainable future for our women and children. It also talks about employment as well and what does decent employment mean. And I think these are very, very important topics. And if the employee can also come down and say, this is what decent employment means for us, and I think that would make more sense. Mm-hmm. But then it's a commendable summit. I can say the topics that have been discussed are very important, and the topics that affects the whole world globally, looking at the stage that we are. So I believe that with this, what the world community needs to look at is how we can transfer information, how we can work together, and how we can close this gap, even if it means just exchanging ideas as well.
Yeah. Obviously, the particular conversations are still happening. I mean, they only started today, Lloyd, and they had some flag-flying situation yesterday, sort of like to officially launch the particular summit itself. But if I can draw your particular attention to some of the talking points that obviously came about, and these talking points start from a notion of, if we look at a just, inclusive, equitable, and sustainable world. Lloyd, in that particular discussion, just and inclusive, I understand the inclusive component and the sustainable component, because we have to look at resources, and that people technically are all included in decisions that apply to our resources and how those resources are used. But when we look at something like just and equitable, which are two particular words that people don't see every day, they hear about them, but in the context of discussion, what does it mean for the ordinary person? So what can you help us to try and understand what the theme regarding just and equitable world, or achieving a just and equitable world?
Yeah, often communities often say we just don't want to be included, but we want to be fully involved in whatever process is happening. And for me, equitability is about trying to level the playing field by using these resources wisely. And in a world where corruption is so rife, using these resources wisely never occurs. And you never see that development. And I think that is where the frustration is. We make so many great plans. Even in our country, we had a Harambe Prosperity Plan. Beautiful plans, beautiful blueprints. But then when it comes to these resources coming practically into our hands, how effectively are we using it? And are we using it them fairly? And that's where the word just also comes in. Am I getting what I fully deserve and what the constitution, what the law, what this world has promised us? Are we getting this, getting that full level of support, even if it means using whatever resources you have, no matter how little, is it equitably being shared? And of course, it's all about, we have to also understand it's all about the amount of effort the individual puts into creating that just system and the amount of accountability that we have in the system. Because without accountability, without having to be able to say this is wrong, and without the spirit of activism, this justice and this equitability is often very difficult. We never have a free willing. So I think we also need to look at how accountable our global systems are, how accountable our institutions are, and that is what we need to look at. Look at the banking fee, for example. Are we looking at how our people on the grassroots can afford this? Yeah, and so there are so many different layers to this topic and so many aspects about it that we can look at. And one can say it's been a huge way, because a lot of the time, like you said, Dwight, we only have the word inclusivity, and we talk mostly about inclusivity, but we don't understand the importance of having an equitable and a just world. So I have to agree with you that one.
Yep, yep. And then the next particular theme, or the aspect, if I can call it an aspect for that matter, because it seems more like a dimension. The next one that pops up is a discussion on poverty eradication, the promotion of full and productive work, and decent work and social integration. In many cases, Lloyd, we've obviously been seeing in a Namibian context how difficult this particular combination has been, because there are so many particular compounding factors that have been present for more than 100 years in Namibia. Just for example, the particular looming impact that, for example, Namibia's genocide has had on the particular social fiber of the country, that we are still sitting with entrenched poverty in many communities across the country. If we look at a scenario like poverty eradication and Namibia's particular example
context.
Does this make our challenge a lot more difficult to try and eradicate poverty?
Looking at our position where we have been, I believe, like you've been talking about our well-being as citizens as well, I believe we experience trauma and we have never found healing for that. And we never understand how that also plays within our productivity levels and our ability to even function and also our ability to be productive citizens, our knowledge base, and we have to, our skills base, for example, perhaps all of this has been affected, right? But then what you have mentioned, I can say Namibia is also finding itself in a different context, in a very difficult position, in a very context, in some context, in a very privileged position, looking at our ability to eradicate the poverty, because we have countries where it's more difficult, for example, when it's ways where there is war, where tribalism is worse, and we have peace, we have the ability.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything IMBA has to offer at an unbeatable price. IMBA, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
I mean, and we have peace. We have the ability to work together. And I mean, with the right leadership, I believe that this country, and I mean, we do have great leadership, but then with more effort, then and the right leadership, we are able to eradicate poverty at the end of the day. And it's not a one way approach. It's an holistic approach, right?
Yeah.
There are different ways we need to look at, creative ways, even looking at sectors that have been undermined and all of it. So there is a lot of effort to look at in terms of strengthening all sectors, in terms of loving the people that cannot be able to stand up for themselves, like for example when we were talking about the basic income grant last year. So we are looking at these different approaches. But then Dwight, you also mentioned something about these different factors being talked about. And I believe on this topic of creation of employment, poverty and all that, we are looking at also at our stress, for example, our young men and women and children also facing stress because of poverty, even workplace stress. So I believe also creating a safe environment at the workplace, I think is also talking about the decent work environment. And that is very important. Because when we're talking about decent employment, we also need to know, am I safe from sexual harassment? Am I safe from exploitation? Am I having a safe space if I'm triggered, if my trauma is triggered, or if I feel depression? These are the different topics that we have to talk about when you talk about decent employment. Apart from the allowance or whatever that I'm getting.
Yeah.
So how are we holistically taking care of our nation at the end of the day? Because if I'm a whole thing, then I can also at the end of the day manage my life, manage my house, manage my stress. So I think that is also what the things I expect will come out from this discussion. Because it's very interesting, and it looks at both creating a job for the unemployed and how we can take care of the employed and how we can create self-employment at the end of the day for the ones that are entrepreneurs too. So looking at this skills, it's an interesting approach.
And obviously, you know, on the aspect of decent work and conducive work environments, or productive employment as they call it, and a promotion of full and productive employment and decent work and social integration, the social integration scenario, Lloyd, is usually a larger particular at investment approach that we have to look at. For example, like all local authorities across Namibia have to play a particular role where they have investments taking place in infrastructure upgrading, you know, driving their own employment agenda in each of their towns and each of their villages and local authorities. And it shouldn't just be a discussion that comes from a Windhoek-based scenario. But if you go outside of Windhoek, you see a clear difference between, let's say, for example, Witvlei and Windhoek. Or if you go even to Rehoboth and Windhoek, and even Okahania and Windhoek, that you see sort of like that firstly, these towns are stuck like 50 or 20 or 30 years in the past, and Windhoek just keeps growing, or certain parts of the country like the coast as well, they just keep advancing, modernizing and growing in that particular scenario. If you look at that discussion of social integration, which is linked, or what they're trying to link to, productive work and decent work standards, obviously this means that we've got to go on a bigger scale of trying to achieve the equitable part that we were talking about in the first question. Firstly, that they've got to invest greatly in the Namibian communities across each town and village.
That's very true. And one thing you also mentioned, it's also very important to look at local authorities' ability in our country to even develop their own towns and cities. And it's true, I have to agree with you. Windhoek has been growing on a fast pace, but then we do find the towns that have been stagnant. And that is a big sign of an unequitable society, because we have to look at the the diversity that we have and how we also want this can benefit our economy as well. Looking at the fact that if we diversify our economy and our market and our talent, and look at, for example, in the South, they had great initiatives about marathon, marathon, but then this initiative, you'll be shocked to find out it will probably be someone from outside of the country or a person that is not from the indigenous community that is bad. Growing that business and making money from that business.
Mm.
And so, yes, it's very important to us that there is also opportunity when we have to diversify. And that is also what our central government has to look at. But then I feel that our local authorities in our country still need to get more teeth and more ability to transform their society, more ability to raise funds, more ability to invest. And there should be more investment also in the local authorities as well, because they are closer to the people. So I think that this is a very, very important topic when it comes to social inclusivity as well as an equitable society.
And Lloyd, obviously the local authorities are one thing, but primarily the government sector is also one thing, because some of the I'd like to call it like unfair calls has been that many people in Namibia who unfortunately don't have jobs would ask for, you know, can't we get employment in the public sector, in the government's civil service. And it sometimes seems that everyone is just looking to the government to sort out their particular needs. But if we even look at community involvement and community projects, which you just now cited a particularly important point, one of the particularly interesting things is that these were people that mobilized themselves. So do you believe that we should actually leverage a lot more of this community-based cooperation?
When it comes to community-based cooperation, I think, as I said, the communities organize themselves differently in terms of that. Because often, even when I was doing my social outreach work, I would find communities where they would organize themselves, and I would find communities where it would be very hard to get people to attend anything or to be part of a community project. And I think this attitude lies within, like you said, often it could also be something like the genocide and their historical past and death and something that they've been caring for a long time, because you find these communities who find it hard to work together. But I believe that it is very important for the community to bring it back. Even if the government comes up with an initiative, this initiative might not be successful if this community does not stand together, or if this community does not come up and say, this is what we want to do, this is how we want to be helped, or this is the idea that we have come up with. And that is where community involvement and the spirit of activism also comes. When we go out of the country, we find that perhaps activism in Namibia is very weak. We don't advocate, and we don't have that activism spirit that we should, in order for us to achieve the goals that we want to achieve, or to hold the government even accountable. Mm. So I believe that comes from the grassroots. We need to do our efforts, that with the central government and also do its efforts. But then if both sides are lacking, I think that is where social injustice itself becomes a sad reality, more in some communities than it is in some other communities.
Mm.
But then also for the government to have an approach with communities that are very reluctant. They might have a reason why they are reluctant, for example.
Mm.
They might not be fond of the government or something. So they need to also have their strategy and their approach to reach out to the people and get those community support.
Yep. Lloyd, there's actually a very good point that also stems from this particular discussion of ours, because we've already have like civil society organizations that are playing that particular part in bridging between impacted communities and the public sector, and in some cases also with private sector, to try and have this integrated cooperation level. Now, you've obviously been now greatly involved with the civil society engagements across Namibia for as long as we know each other. And I've only seen, in terms of us being a radio journalist, you know, in terms of that, okay, we see the targeted interventions that civil society tries to bring, which are more of these community engagements. And you actually see it's a discussion that they try to literally do a role or a job or a part that was supposed to be done by a, let's say, a local authority or by a ministry for that matter. Do you think we should be, does it actually mean that we've got to strengthen civil society in that particular role? Or should it be a discussion of actually assisting civil society in achieving their particular goals as well as also achieving national goals like the ones found in NDP6?
Okay, yeah, just for example, looking at the NDP6, and that our role was facilitated up by NPC, National Planning Commission, and the European Union's Commission, the EBDN Commission. So, and that was beautiful to see, and I think that is one example where there were open discussions, even during that stakeholder engagement that they were having. And so, looking at the fact that the civil society need support. And I believe at one point the National Planning Commission wanted to come up with a partnership policy between civil society and the government, but it's still in process and it has not been realized yet. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are still discussions around it. Yeah, so I mean at some point we have seen efforts, but at some point that also those efforts prove that although it has not been a reality yet, it is a need. There is a need for that partnership. There is a need for that support system. Possible society to be supported. Looking at the fact that even though with the USAID funding being cut, a lot of civil societies are currently suffering, and we need, and a lot of other civil societies to shut down. Mm-hmm. So we need that ability of the government to also intervene in that sector and say, hey, how can we get more funding? Should we create a little focus fund for civil society, or how can we help civil society survive in case we lose international donor funding? So I think that is what the local government should consider to help support the civil society. Because at the end of the day, just as much as often some government officials see civil society as an enemy, they play an important role in bridging the gap and in helping the government find the solution that they need. And it's also
sorry, Lloyd, really? Does some government agency see civil society as sort of like being an enemy or being hostile to?
Yeah, as an opposition. And it has been a long-laying notion that often civil society can be seen as opposing the government or as an activist against the government.
Yeah.
Sometimes we need to those misunderstandings to be cleared out, to understand that we are partners and that we are friends and that we are supporting each other and so that we can be able to achieve our goals.
Mm.
But then, what the same issue that we have been mentioning of the cities, I believe that civil society is highly concentrated also in regions again.
Mm.
And one thing that civil society also needs to do in the region is also looking at reaching out to the smaller communities, like you said. And I think the government can support them in doing that as well.
Yeah, yeah. On the next particular talking point, Lloyd, if we cite the aspect in terms of, let me just pull up my notes. In terms of looking also at the discussions that has taken place, meaning the reasons for the summit that's taking place now, but there were reasons that they discussed at previous notions. For example, they mentioned the Copenhagen Declaration. And in the declaration, they cite that countries have seen global wealth of the nations and the trade between these nations have grown by more than 50 times. And that life expectancy has also improved, but that there's also far too many women and children that are vulnerable and that are exposed to stress and deprivation. Now, we obviously see this because in a Namibian context, you technically see the two contrasts, the two pictures in sort of like in live color, in HD, in full definition color. This obviously speaks towards the equitable and the inclusivity components we discussed in the first question. But when we look at the potential of trade for Namibia's discussion, I've heard many times civil society championing, for example, the universal basic income grant is a possible solution to try and combat the particular inequality that Namibia suffers. And that the other component is that why not try to couple some sort of of an initiative to help, like you also now referenced, civil society or particular community initiatives in terms of improving development across the country. Is this the particular pathway that we've got to stick by, that you've also seen, you know, that this is something that civil society and other particular advocates for community development have also echoed in terms of, let's try and couple initiatives that is trying to change lives and improve lives with literally the wealth that is generated from the trade that Namibia makes?
Well, from the side of our civil society, we believe, basically, let us combine both rather than scrubbing out the idea of a universal basic income credit, looking at the particular fact that how can we ensure not only equitability but fairness within this process? Because we have at the national, apart from the National Youth Development Fund, we have also other initiatives like National Youth Council. We did have some other initiatives that have not yielded in this equitability. Like you said, men and women are underchecked. Who do we know which women benefit from this initiative and which women can apply and benefit from this initiative? We had the National Youth Development Fund, and only a certain amount of people will be able to benefit from that. And maybe all of the ideas are perfect.
Yeah.
All of the ideas could have made a profit. Benefit. But then we look at the promising one. But then looking at the point of me sitting and reading at someone's paper, I don't know.
Why pay more when you can pay less? At USAID, 400 milliliter Dawn hand and body lotion or cream, just $29.99. 350 milliliter trusted palm olive shampoo and conditioner, just $38.99 each. Lovey's premium disposable nappies, $133.99. Any 2 1-kilogram bags Sunlight 5-in-1 hand washing powder, just $58. Save $2. You save, I save, we all save at USAID.
And joining the African continent, we've now once again seen, you know, that conflicts are becoming
the promising one. But I'm looking at a point of me sitting and reading at someone's paper. I don't know whether in practicality these proposals would have yielded much more productive results or created more employment than the others. So often it has been very difficult for especially when it comes to the state, when the state is involved, to be able to pinpoint who benefits and who doesn't, to be able to ensure that there is fairness within the process. And so that's why we always advocate for the universal basic income grant, not as the only solution to poverty, but as a co-plan just to ensure the survival. Like you said, well, often children have if I have a business and my children will not involve them busy operating on their business, but this basic income grant can help me at the end of the day to buy that one graph, to buy that one sugar another day. And so that is what we actually advocate. Not to say that it's gonna solve all the problems, but it's gonna be a massive solution to the current crisis that we are in.
100%. And Lloyd, obviously there are other messages specifically that come through from the Copenhagen Declaration that is sort of like the foundation document to the social justice summit taking place in Qatar. One of them is obviously a very pertinent but sometimes ignored discussion in terms of peace and security. Now, obviously the African continent, we've now once again seen, you know, that conflicts are becoming a lot more worse and that they're actually being elongated, meaning they go on for longer. In that particular discussion, obviously, the threat is always that this is based upon inequality that is rife within countries, as well as also that you find heightened levels of government corruption. And in many cases, you also see armies and specifically, you know, military heads of the army trying to commit coups d'etats or coups, attempted coups, in terms of taking control of of a country just to also enrich themselves. If we look at that particular discussion within the broader African context, I'm not sorry, but, you know, throwing you into the weatherman aspect for the broader African discussion, but this obviously makes things 10 times more difficult to try and alleviate the poverty, eradicate the deprivation, and also try to deal with the inequalities, right?
Yeah, perfect. And especially where war and conflict is involved. And I think that is where that global partnership often comes in handy. Looking at the fact that perhaps in Sudan, for example, this country might not be able to solve its own problems by itself. So we need that fair intervention from the global body, of course, from the neighboring countries trying to intervene. But I have to say you are perfectly correct. Peace and security plays a vital role. As I also mentioned, perhaps although we might be in a difficult position because of our diversity and our past, we might be in a much more easier position to get out of poverty because we are a peaceful country and we don't have tires burning in the streets and burning trucks and all that. So looking at how we can understand perhaps why we have this, maybe it's because we have a much smaller population. This could be factors, but then it's a crucial factor in order for poverty to be eradicated, not for productivity itself to happen. Because productivity is low, and if productivity is low, income is personal basic income for the personal household is quite low or non-exist. So that's what I would say, yeah, that is crucial, and that might be I'm curious to see the discussions that come out of this topic at the summit.
100%. Now, Lloyd, in terms of just getting into the last point before I let you go, the discussion obviously has been one about, you know, trying to achieve the sort of like the most conducive, best scenario of social integration where jobs actually mean something and actually pay decent wages, whereby people can live in peaceful neighborhoods and communities across the world. But obviously, when we look at a Namibian context, you will sometimes find some of the older generations of people in Namibia who cited a similar scenario and who could actually, you know, they actually have a little bit of nostalgia looking back in history pre-independence or just a little bit after independence in terms of living in a community that technically they had decent wages, they had sufficient amount in terms of earning potential, but that between independence and up to now, the level of affordability has become or has actually sort of like spiraled out of control, and now we've actually just exacerbated things that potentially were slightly just under the surface. For example, unemployment, the rate at which jobs can be created because of investments and the likes. Has this been something that you might have seen as a social justice activist and advocate in the Namibian, a broader Namibian scene?
Great.
Yes, do you hear me?
I lost you there for a while. Can you repeat the question?
100%. I was just explaining specifically in terms of if we look at the optimum levels of social integration, as well as also the ability to have jobs that actually pay meaningful wages and that contribute to productivity in each economy around the world, and specifically also in Namibian context. But there are some generations still present in Namibia who can speak towards a period where they actually did enjoy something like that, even though that was just before our independence, or slightly just past the independence. And the difference that we've been looking at has technically how life has become a lot more expensive since 1990 up until now, 2025. Have you encountered similar particular sort of like viewpoints of older people, you know, from grandfathers, grandmothers and the likes, who said, you know, looking back, they used to enjoy conditions under certain eras of Namibia's existence?
You know, Dwight, I always used to say, when I observe the community in which I grew up, and I grew up in Kapitura, I often say perhaps looking at the entire community is run by and also owned by people from the previous generation. I always say, oh, those times were difficult, they might have had it somehow easy in some kind of, in some way. And I also would agree with that because once people want to say the level of affordability and the level of accessibility was also easy, and the ability, like you said, to find a good job. Let's say we would not find the contract labor system type of a job that would come pick you up in your community so that you can go work and sign you up, right? Although it was capacity. So that type of a system is not available. And we don't, probably most people don't like that, you know, looking at the members coming back. But then looking at that, there were so many changes that happened after independence that made life very difficult. You know, for example, the older generation would get a house and live at the age of 25, for example. So when you are asking this question, we have to look at the system and how it has changed, and perhaps we could not help to change the system in the way and the way they would have to turn up, because this problem might not be unique to Namibia, but we have citizens in South Africa also making the same sentiment. So one would look at what were the factors that contributed to this. You know, of course, cost of production has increased, perhaps the government has increased, has changed, and all of this might have contributed to it, but there might be a whole lot of factors that if we look at this factors, we might be able to come up with a creative solution. And that's why this type of question looks back at our parents' ability to maintain and to make it, and perhaps their mindset, and perhaps our change in mindset also affects our ability to make it even easier.
100%. Lloyd, if there's still something that I have not, that I've forgotten to ask, that you still want to add before we conclude our discussion, you can still do so.
Yeah, no, all I wanted to say was, this is a topic that is being discussed on a global level, but it affects actually everyone, you know, even down to the children. So we are looking forward to the solutions. We're looking forward to the ideas that will be discussed this summer. And yeah, thank you so much for having me, Lloyd.
100%. Lloyd, thank you once again for taking the time to talk to us and our listeners.
Thank you.
Now, coming back there from that in-depth discussion, dear listeners, obviously various particular talking points stem from as what had been highlighted there. And obviously, just to cite once again, just after the discussion, you can call 0833-288-401 in terms of your caller's contribution. We've got a decent amount of time left still for this particular morning session, but it's as was indicated there with my particular guest in that, discussion right there, is that you have to look at a myriad of particular discussions that currently have to take place in this context for this 3-day summit taking place in Qatar. And specifically, viewing all the particular sort of like complex talking points, wherein every one of them are not unique, separated, isolated, or function in any particular sort of like compartmentalized function or fashion in terms of the overall fabric of the Namibian identity in this country. All of this obviously also cites the particular, if you can use the word, or for a better usage of a word, the baggage that we've got to try and sort out ultimately in terms of achieving prosperous futures for coming generations or future generations. And specifically also when you factor in a discussion where you had to look at where we looked at the World Population Report of 2025, and this was back in August, July of this year, where that World Population Report cited the most pertinent talking points that actually stress young people and people for future generations, or to trying to build for future generations coming ahead. But before we continue, guys, we quickly take a short break, and after that we come back.
Say Save the date for November 26, 2025, when all registered voters head to the polls for the regional councils and local authorities elections. Your voice matters, and your vote is your voice. Head to your nearest polling station and elect your leaders. Remember, every vote counts. Get involved. Put your voice in the box. Vote on November 26, 2025.
Coming back there from the ad break, dear listeners, and once again, you're listening to the Early Morning Scoop here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, specifically for this Wednesday morning session. Now, where we left off just before the break, and if you've just tuned in, I'm sorry, you technically missed some insightful and wonderful conversations and subject matter up to this particular point, but still, we welcome you in terms of the discussions still to be contained in the rest of your programming here with us, Eagle FM, on this Wednesday. And obviously, the talking point just before the break that cites or states or comes from the discussion is, that's not the discussion with my guest, that being Mr. Lloyd Bock, in terms of taking a look at the talking points in terms of, developing and achieving conducive levels, or a level specifically where all society at the whole can benefit from various particular developments and also potentially investments and also potential, if we can call it, initiatives that help to achieve social cohesion and some sort of a social integration and some sort of platform where everyone potentially can have more access to employable opportunities or business venturing opportunities and the likes. Now, the one key thing specifically that stands at the heart of this particular talking point happening in Qatar is the Copenhagen Declaration. Now, the Copenhagen Declaration, dear listeners, was a document specifically that was agreed upon in 1995, basically, just to set the scene for you. In 1995, for Namibia's particular context, 5 years after we became independent. But in that 5-year bracket, for example, if you start from Namibia's particular discussion, we had to sort out so many things before this particular, before we could even see ourselves primarily taking part in this particular conversation of this document. Because the Copenhagen Declaration on Social Development, it's also a little bit of a reflection on the country who actually hosted this particular summit in 1995 and where it currently stands today. If you had to factor in the following two reports that we've cited, dissected here on Eagle FM and specifically on the Home Run as well. And we're talking about the World Happiness Report and you're talking about the World Population Report. These two particular reports. Now, the World Happiness Report has got nothing to do with the UN. It leverages certain particular UN statistics and it is obviously based upon a survey, independent survey done by another agency. And the report itself was compiled and constituted by another particular global think tank or NGO itself. And they worked together, compiled this discussion so as to put forward a myriad of talking points that give a reflection of why people would be perceived to be happy in one country and why people would be perceived as not being satisfied with the current status of their lives in their own particular countries. Oh, there's a third report, sorry. And then there's the Human Development Index report as well, which looks at healthcare, life expectancy, exposure to educational factors, as well as also the discussion in terms of what particular pathways to economic participation an individual in a country has. So you've technically got three reports to literally leverage from to give you a substantive sort of like picture. But that substantive picture can also come through from Namibia's National Development Plan, Namibia's previous national development frameworks, for example, the Harambe Prosperity Plans 1 and 2, the NDP-5 before that, which was running in this, parallel to those two particular plans, and other things further on. For example, if you had to look at the discussion talking about, if you now had to go and do a census and a survey now in Namibia, okay, not a census, but a survey rather, of people's particular satisfaction or their perceived levels of happiness with regards to various talking points. Access to affordable medical care, access to affordable housing, access to affordable services, and as well as also having the opportunity of potentially, earning some sort of a living. Go and have that exercise in Namibia and see how far you'll potentially get with, you'll see the range primarily of satisfaction and dissatisfaction. But before we continue, let's get the first caller coming through. Eagle FM, good morning.
Good morning, Dwight. How are you?
Good and you, Angabona. How are you doing?
Cool, man. Yeah, that thing, I've been following it up. That platform.
Mm.
Where they are talking about social development. Is in this area sometimes we neglect it. We look at the only this area, economic, political, and issue of that nature. But this social development, these social issues, that brings more looked at human development as well. And you see that many a times, like you said, 1995, just a few years after we got our independence, and we are already in that wagon. So it is important that the areas of safety, what is it, safety net, that area is important and for development. Like people were talking about now the budget that the government is now borrowing money from within or wherever is also coming from outside, I don't know, for consumption. And you see that people are actually targeting that vulnerable population where there is a need. And also infrastructure, the roads and all these other things. There are many, many things that need to be somehow incorporated, integrated, so that the system as a whole can talk to each other and the alignment. Because many a times talk about social development, but focusing only on the aspect of money, for example, the economic aspect. And that economic aspect will definitely have a direct impact on the social life of the people. So even when people are talking about the business, let's say in the CDB, like it has been going on yesterday, people are being harassed, people are being taken away from their operation. Of course, the municipal bylaw, which need to be reformed as responsive to the social need of the people. That area, I don't know why it's not, it's neglected. Yesterday I asked a question, on the talk of the nation. What the program that was going on yesterday here. And there was a legal person, a lawyer from the Ministry of Justice. And they pose a question, why is it taking so long to reform those municipal bylaw? And the answer was, it is us to organize ourselves and challenge some of those laws that are not working.
Do you know, Angel Bonas, it's actually a good thing that you mentioned that, because I tried looking for those municipal bylaws and I only keep coming up to the Local Authorities Act. Every time to try and understand, you know, for example, what are these municipal bylaws that people would reference? Because you're not the first person that has mentioned this. A brother of mine has mentioned it at one stage as well. You've got to look at municipal bylaws, because remember the conversation that Helmut and I had back in last year about affordable housing and using affordable construction methods to construct houses. You know, in terms of, because if you have to look at the input costs of building a house today for people and the mass housing project, at the heart of everything is the cost, you know, the input costs.
Yes.
And the input costs
people kept referencing, no, it's some sort of a bylaw. It's Ministry of Works' particular legislation on the materials that you can use. I tried looking for those things. I can't find those things specifically, which is technically trying to tell me that either this resource has not been shared and it's hidden somewhere, you know, like in a dusty shelf. And now municipal bylaws pop up every time where if you just go and focus on the Local Authorities Act, then a municipal bylaw pops up saying, yeah, you can't do this in this town. You can't do that in this town, which is a good thing, Uncle Bono, because we have to bring out this particular set of rules. What are they? What do they look like? Because in many cases, the Ministry of Urban and Rural Development will come and cite to you the Local Authorities Act, and they will just take something.
Apparently, in our constitutions, those things that, like a municipal bylaw that I'm referring to, specifically the one that I think the proclamation that of 1957, somewhere there, is still intact. And according to the lawyer, he said that in our constitution, those things there, they need to be embedded in there.
Yeah.
Because the constitution said people have got the right for commerce, to trade, and they have got this right for water.
Yeah.
And they are entitled to all these principles,
yeah,
that for human rights,
yeah,
that are not actually embedded in, are not in there.
Yeah, but it's not covered there, but the Constitution covers it here, and you can clearly see that there's a conflict scenario between these two sets, but that the old one is still in practice.
It's still in practice, and people are using that. So to chase away people, let's say, from the CDB, so to demarcate the market there, and like you were saying, I don't know when, how do people get in there? Let's say the government employees who are working in town, for example, and if you create the market somewhere very far,
yeah,
how can a person walk from the government office park to now go there and buy those things there instead of just getting the ones that are here? Between in front of your office. So those are some of the issues. Even if we seriously need to specifically point out the registration that prevents people from selling on those areas there.
Yeah.
Even if we do not know, but we know that the municipal officials who are chasing away people, are they not using a law to chase people out, to chase people away from that site? It's the same law that you are going to use to turn it to work in the favor of the masses, of the people who are doing that kind of business. So the provision should be there. The ones that the municipality is using, we can capitalize and analyze that law so that it can be changed where it does not benefit the people. I think there's a serious work to be done to identify specific laws that are preventing people from enjoying the benefits. I don't know, maybe we still need to look at it. I will call some guys to look at that local authority legal instrument to see whether there is a need, but according to him, say, let's identify those loopholes and then address and challenge them so that they can be amended.
100%, Uncle Bona. Because the
thank you very much.
Not a problem. Thanks for coming through.
Cool.
And as we're about left with a particular minute still to engage here on the early morning scoop session, dear listeners, it's a holistic picture, because the reason why I cited the three reports, the caller's contribution as well right now, in terms of looking at, like, if you get into on the ground impacting aspects or dimensions, that you can literally see that potentially there are limiting factors, or there are factors that are restrictive or limiting in terms of that they impose a limitation. When you look at these particular dynamics, when you assess these particular aspects and conditions. And when you look at things, for example, like the three reports just before the caller's contribution that I stated, these are all particular feeding in, you know, they continuously feed into a national particular setting and platform that I either, well, it scales up to a particular level that, you know, you start seeing, okay, wow, we've been training so many Namibians to have theoretical skills. Yes, we've achieved an 80% literacy rate. But if you look at skills development side, now that we are trying to bring in developments in the mining sector, in the green hydrogen and manufacturing sector specifically, now we're sitting with a major deficit and we have to play a catch up game to try and train technicians, welders specifically for certain sectors, and even increase the levels of these particular sectors, or these particular educational sectors to participate in these new sectors that have to be introduced. And these particular developments make things tricky because you literally have to view a particular talking point that looks, it has a tricky nuance to it and it has a tricky particular dimension to it. But before we continue, dear listeners, we'll quickly take a short break and come back right after this.
The early birds catches the worms. That's right. Tune in to Early Morning Scoop with David Chombeye, where he unpacks global affairs, analyze issues, dive into the aspects of human development, connecting policymakers with the citizens, and encouraging critical, constructive, and positive criticism Monday to Friday from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. Don't miss out.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite okoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano hile koshuana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa nune uto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijemo ili nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onoreta tuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
It's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And just in terms of getting back to you, dear listeners, from that quick extended break right there, this ultimately does bring us up to the end to this morning's early morning scoop. And ultimately, dear listeners, stay tuned for the next program to follow on immediately, that being the Unpacking the Day with my colleague Mike, who's standing by in terms of taking over in terms of the conversation and continuing it right after this.